The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
We do not know when it will be safe to go outside. We only know that day is not this day.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 458, the week of May 8th, 2023. I am birth control nugget David T. Cole, and I'm here with mayoral baby blanky Sarah D. Bunting.
Knit one, airlock two.
Post-apocalyptic vuvuzelist Tara Ariano. And raging silo bottom Richard Lawson.
I meant I live at the bottom of the silo, nothing else.
All right. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Before we bring in our guest and lead topic, a bit of pod business up top. We hit the next milestone since I think we last talked on EHG Prime. But anyways, just to recap, coming this Friday on Extra Extra Hot Great, that is our new bonus end of week episode, we'll debut the new segment, Not Quite Winners and Losers of the Week, where each of us pick a loser and a winner we didn't use in the Prime version of it, and we discuss, because there's always lots of good stuff there that we kind of want to dig into, but we just don't have the time. So that will debut this Friday. And also part of that milestone that is now active, we're doing a crowdsource sticker. Supporters have already made some suggestions. The voting is happening right now for which one will be made and then sent free to any supporter who requests one. And that voting ends end of day this Friday. So if you're on the Patreon, there's a post on Patreon with the poll link. If you're on the Discord, the same thing is there in the stickers channels. Our top contenders at the moment are the I Am Not a Crackpot typewriter, the Is This Benson multi-Benson design idea. These are all ideas, not yet designed, so you have to use your imagination. I believe that one would be the face of Benson Benson with the hair of SVU Benson and the overall gumball covering of regular show Benson as one entity. Yep. As this terror of TV.
Of course.
And then finally, I think our third spot, and these are definitely the front runners, is the Tiny Triumph mini sticker set. So instead of one sticker, you get a whole bunch of little things that say Tiny Triumph that you can stick on people's foreheads or a banana. Why not? Grandpa update. Remember all our problems with grandpas and people that have upgraded from grandpas were getting two episodes. And I was like, maybe it has something to do with the billing cycle. Looks like that is the case. I doubt Patreon is going to fix that bug anytime soon. So if you upgrade your grandpa account to a full EHG full episode tier, you may, for the first couple weeks, get both versions of that episode. And then it'll tail off once your billing cycle turns over. And a reminder, if you do upgrade your account from that $2 level to the new $5 minimum, you must be in a tier. A couple people got caught in that little trap Patreon sets up. So you must upgrade. Click on the tier button. Even if your name, your own price is exactly the same amount, Patreon's like, I don't understand. And it won't give you the perks and you won't get that episode in your feed. So please be aware of that. If you have any troubles, please feel free to email me, david@cole.fyi. Thank you all so very much. We're so happy the way this is progressing. The second show has become super fun, and we'll go into more details about what's coming at you subject-wise this Friday later in the show.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you to all our Patreons and to all prospective Patreons and to everyone listening to the free feed. Thank you to everyone within the sound of my voice. Let's get into this episode. Our guest is the chief critic at Vanity Fair. You have heard him with us here before many times. Welcome back, Richard Lawson!
Richard!
Hello, I'm so happy to be back to talk about living in this hole with you guys.
Well, let's get into it because my last question may now be my first question. So let's first describe what we're talking about. It is the Apple TV Plus show Silo, and here's what that is about. With the environment ravaged and the air itself so badly contaminated, it kills all life instantly. The very last people on Earth live underground in, guess what, a silo. There are 10,000 of them, so it's extremely elaborate and goes down more than 100 levels deep. None of the silo residents know exactly why they're there, who built the silo, or why anything outside the silo is as it is, partly because 140 years ago, there was an uprising during which the rebels erased all of their computer servers and burned all their books. Huh, but what if the official story is not the truth? The show is based on a book series by Hugh Howey. Justified creator Graham Yost adapted it for TV. He also wrote the pilot. Two episodes dropped last Friday on Apple TV Plus. Some of us have seen more, but we will be careful about spoilers. Let us do the Chen check-in just very briefly. Should our listeners watch Silo, Richard?
Yes.
Sarah?
I could pretend I didn't read some things, but I did. And because I did, no, but it's a qualified no. We'll get into it.
Dave?
It's a qualified yes, and I think for the exact same reason as Sarah. Mm-hmm. I just think the first season is worth watching on its own merits.
I agree with Dave. I watched all of the first season, and I am probably done. But we'll see if they even make more. Yeah. I mean, Apple TV Plus does like to renew stuff. So let's get into it. And I'm going to start with my last question, because you kind of alluded to it in your intro name. Richard, is anyone in the silo queer? At the end of it, I was like, wait a second. Something is missing. Did you note this as well?
You think the second they got rid of the books, they didn't get rid of the gay people?
Okay, great. Oof. Point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I suppose it has been many generations since the big actions. Yeah, that is a weird glaring flaw. I mean, kind of absence on the show, but kind of contributes in a way to like the sort of syndicated Saturday Deep Space Nine feel of the whole show.
Yeah.
Like it feels quaint and dated in a way that I don't hate. Like I kind of was into its like very familiar setup and storytelling.
Yeah.
Boy, I love that comparison because I was having such a hard time explaining to Tara why it felt weird, because it was like either cheap expensive or expensive cheap, and I couldn't figure out what it was. You know, is it the weird lighting because we're in the silo, makes everything look like it didn't have enough contrast or whatever, but it really is just like this overall syndicated programming sort of tone to some of the proceedings.
Yeah, Richard, you reviewed the series at Vanity Fair. We'll link it in the show notes. And yeah, you this was a comparison that you brought up in that review as well. And it is true, like you called it a cozy throwback. The people in the silo compared to the ones in The Last of Us or Station 11, which you cite, they are thriving in a limited way. So talk about that. Why cozy was the word that you used?
Because it's just about learning a world, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, and all the, you know, remember there was that SNL sketch, like a pre-taped thing, like maybe 10 years ago when like Maze Runner was out and Hunger Games was out, just making fun of all the terms, you know, greenies and blueies and whatever the fuck else. And and this show has a similar thing where you're learning like, okay, so the people who live in the middle of the silo are sort of the middle class, and like there are terms for people at the bottom and at the top. And like, I just thought that was sort of fun in a way that I was really sick of it 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now it feels kind of new. Maybe it won't when the Hunger Games prequel comes out or whatever. But
like,
yeah, it is a depressing show about dark things. But at the same time, it's also a cop procedural in a world I wanted to learn more about. And then when I finished the season, I read more about it and we'll never watch it again.
Yep.
All right, good. Glad we're on the same page.
Yeah, we're going to link that in the show notes as well, because Dave dug up a post from the book author's blog.
Yeah.
And the more you read, the more you're like, good God, how much work did Graham Yost have to do to make this writer into TV material?
All right, let's get into that later, though. Let's get into what makes this season good.
All right. So usually with a show like this, and we've certainly talked about many, I have tons of practical and logistical questions about the world that's been built, and we've already sort of touched on this, Richard did. But this one anticipated more of my questions than I expected. And Sarah, as a process nerd, I wonder, was there enough of it for you?
there was actually exactly enough, because I think the tightrope that shows like this are always up on is like, you want to suggest enough to give yourself some room to fill things in later. How this ended up manifesting in blog form, we'll talk about later. But in terms of this show, for someone who was not familiar with the story and hadn't read the book,
yeah,
I felt like I was given enough process and enough also sort of like dialogue and the writing's ability to kind of assume that we can infer and keep the line moving was was really good. I really liked that balance, and that it was believably elliptical and not, especially in the first couple of episodes, people explaining to each other like they're peta conferencing on CSI.
Right.
Like, well,
right.
This new fingerprint does, like, are you fucking kidding me? This person has a PhD. Like,
yeah.
They did really well with that, and I thought it was well cast and well acted. So the processy part of me for something like this, like, sometimes I really want nuts and bolts, like, give me a flashback to the building of the silo. But in this case, I think that because they needed to leave some things unsaid and unshown to maintain tension, that the process was a part of that. But again, I can't unknow things. I suggest that if you started the show and found it enjoyable, that you not investigate further. Mm-hmm. All that air went out of my being impressed balloon. And now I'm like, why, you know, I don't care. But I don't think it's impossible for the show to like turn shit around. So
In the context of the one season, it really, and all the process and the terms and all that, it really helps immensely that everyone living in the silo has been born there.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally get that they would have terminology that is kind of dense and a sort of understanding of their world that we have to figure out. It's much more glaring when it's like the Maze Runner and some kid from presumably our world shows up and within 2 days is using all the terms. You know, like
right.
No one in this first season of Silo isn't from the silo.
Right.
So like that helps, I think, a great deal in immersing us in the world.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the terms, the jargon, the coziness that Richard alluded to in his review even extends out to what they call it when they send someone outside to their death as punishment for a crime or just because they asked to go, which is they say someone has gone out to clean, which makes it seem like they're just puttering around on a Sunday morning.
Got one of the one of the sticks with a nail in it, and they're just picking up O. Henry wrappers from the ground.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was funny. And I also, in your to harken back to Richard's review again, I was glad to see you muse about how big the set was, because I wondered the same thing. Like, I'm obviously, a lot of it is CGI, but it's hard to tell when they're running from level to level, like how big is this thing? Do you know anything about the production, Richard?
No. I should have looked into it. I didn't, but like maybe I wanted to let the mystery be, as they used to say in Leftovers.
Sure.
But like it's got to be a few levels, right? Because there are many, many shots of them walking up this huge circular staircase.
Yes.
And like maybe they swap out some rooms, different production, you know, different set dressing and all that stuff. But like, I think, you know, whether or not there was just like they were walking on like bright green platforms that then were sort of given texture in post, even still, they must have been in a massive kind of facility when shooting this.
Yeah, yes, for sure. Yeah. Dave sort of referred to the expensive cheapness or cheap expensiveness. But let's talk about the production design and go to Dave, because, you know, Deep Space Nine is a great reference. But I also thought of Snowpiercer, the movie, which Richard mentions, the show, obviously a lot cheaper looking. But Battlestar Galactica 2, and not just in the airlockness of it. So, Dave, talk about how the texture of this world worked for you or didn't.
Yeah, I thought they did a pretty good job making it feel lived in a way like you can't go out to Home Depot and find, you know, get some new 2x4s for the roof or whatever.
Yeah.
One of the problems I have, and I think this is something we said on the Mrs. Davis discussion on Extra, Extra Hot, Great, which is when set designers or CG people are tasked with aging up stonework or iron and stonework, they usually go overboard with like the rust stains and everything. It starts to look like a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or Fight Club.
Yeah. Here they pulled back on that. It wasn't as bad as all that. So on top of that sort of thing, I think where they failed in that were anytime there was a sign. For some reason, the signs were just like totally over the top, like all the types of distress. There's like rust edges plus distress plus paint peeling plus this
bullet hole.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like too much. It was like your bag of tricks. Just take out two things and use it.
Yeah.
But what I did like was the touches were like everybody's room, no matter where you're the mayor or you're one of the down deep people in engineering at the bottom of the silo, everybody's room's like cracked to shit just because like the foundation, you know, the pressure is just crazy, you know, right? And so everybody's room has like the big crack. Wherever you are in the world, there's maintenance going on. Mm-hmm. That gave it a good lived in look. Like if you haven't seen it yet, it sort of looks like the interiors of Luke Skywalker's house on Tatooine everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I thought they did a good job with that.
I also noted, and I assume, Sarah, you did too, that when you see anyone in knitwear, because you are a knitter, you could see where they had been mended, like that there was like artful sort of stitching around. In the first episode, there's a sweater that Rashida Jones' characters wear where there's clearly been some kind of chewing. I assume it's not moths, but something has happened to the sweater sleeve where they've sort of embellished it with the stitching. And I appreciated that it looked like stuff had been reused.
I agree. And that sort of the color scheme was not, it was like just on the edge of this relentless like brown and olive drab.
Yeah. So. Richard calls it earth tone despair in his reviews. Mm-hmm. Speak on that, Richard.
It's a genre, you know. There is an episode where they mention like very explicitly a janitorial staff, and you're like, okay, so what? I guess they're just cleaning like the cafeteria and not necessarily the hallways and whatnot.
Yeah,
I could have used a little bit more explanation for why these all aren't like pale skinned people with rickets. I don't remember if there is reference to like a UV anything, because that especially the people living way at the bottom, it's like that, you know, I think some of the sustainability of the silo, like maybe that gets explained in further books and subsequent seasons of the show if they exist, but like maybe a little bit to like draw us into the credibility of like, yeah, I could see how a society could function like this for, you know, I think it's 140 years, they've said.
Yeah.
Part of the joy of watching a show like this for me is picking apart the systems they don't explain, and they're just like, why are there cows here? Like, cows are the most inefficient source of protein for a very small amount of land that you could probably do. You know, like, their protein would probably be plant-based if they really wanted to be sustainable. Or
bugs. Or babies.
Or at least something that lays an egg that you can use.
Right. Yeah.
Right. But also things like, there are hints that there is a manufacturing base somewhere in the silo, but that's never really brought up. Like, where are they making this? Where are they making that? You know, where are the sheriff's badges coming from?
Yeah.
Where are the uniforms coming from? And all this sort of stuff. Like, obviously, there are floors that are just industrial floors, but, you know, you don't really get a glimpse of that. And that's not to say that I therefore do not believe it happened in universe, but these are the things I enjoy. Like, where'd they get that?
Yeah.
Come on.
There's like towards the end of the season, we meet a doctor. We spend a lot of time in this doctor's office, and we see like on a shelf, you know, like boxes of medical supplies and stuff. And they're all identical and all printed. It's like, they've already established very early on that paper is extremely precious.
Right.
It's like, who is going to trouble printing these boxes in whatever factory is making like syringes, let's assume, or whatever it is. Right. Anyway, yeah, funny stuff like that. So we're in the spoiler zone. Let's talk about the structure of the series. It premieres with two episodes that are, you know, a lot of world building, like we're talking about establishing the characters and how the world works. But then after that, the show kind of just has a whole other protagonist from there on. Richard, is this a risky strategy for a show in the streaming era of like, we're just going to trust you to come with us, and if you don't, whatever, I guess? What do you think about that?
I mean, I liked, as a critic, as a viewer, like the idea that you don't meet the actual protagonist of the season until well into episode two, really, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then, you know, and I think that that's exciting. It brings to mind the opening credits of the OA, which come 40-something minutes into the first episode. And you're right. Like, it just feels like interesting stylistically. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps a great deal that when we meet our lead, it's Rebecca Ferguson, who is such an amazing actor. Obviously is probably most famous at this point for Dune. This is a nice kind of sci-fi companion to that. She's just so compelling and watchable. And yeah, so if it had been someone a little flatter, maybe someone who would have been on one of those syndicated Saturday shows back in the day, I think it would have been a struggle to miss David Oyelowo especially. Mm-hmm. But I think with Ferguson in the lead, like, I think it's fun to kind of hold her until a couple episodes in and with this as a surprise.
Yeah. And the smart thing to do with the casting of the episode one leads, the husband and wife, the sheriff and his wife, is that they are big enough names that when at the end of that episode one, you're like, I wonder if what I saw is what I like. It's
right.
Their real world prominence made me question what was happening in the universe. And it's not often you get to genuinely trade off things that way. But I feel like it worked here, and I was pleased by that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also think about Rebecca Ferguson. Like, a lot of times when you see this sort of, this tropey female character, it's like, she's shut down and unemotional, and she's, like, grubby. Like, it's usually a very glamorous actor's, because actresses are, but she, I bought her in this role in a way that, like, maybe not since Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow did I buy someone who was like that. Sarah, what did you think of her?
I expected, because it is that character, but then they very smartly have my queen and yours, Harriet Walter, being like, oh, now you're going to do that thing where you can't talk about, like, give me a fucking break. And then she just is like, so here's the deal. And then she doesn't hold anything, but it's not like this soapy, contrived, like, well, I'm not going to tell you any part of this for your own safety, because it's Harriet Walter. She can fucking take care of herself. So that's, I mean, this is the thing, like, this, the build of this show, I just wish I had not clicked on that link, but I did. So the build of this show is, I think, very smart, very satisfying. And I think that's down to a showrunner who's sort of used to having to maintain this kind of tension.
Yeah.
Also, it's nice to see Adam from Yellow Jackets rambling around in the bells of the silo.
Yeah, but then he never comes back. It's weird. I mean, spoiler.
I don't think he had like a line.
Okay? I'm not even sure he had one, honestly. But yes, I think the switcheroo does make you think, like, oh, anyone could go at any time, which I think is always good for a show. Like, even the Famos might be departing. But speaking of Famos, Common, Dave, do you want to speak on the performance of Common?
I thought that character could have been a lot better in somebody else's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Common seems like a cool guy, but he's playing like that same killer cool plays a lot, like in John Wick, you know, where he's got to do what he's got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got family back home. I wanted somebody more dynamic in that role.
Yeah.
I think you need to believe him as a zealot.
Mm.
And you don't, because he's kind of flat and one note. You have Tim Robbins kind of playing that side of things as the season goes. I did want to go back to something Sarah mentioned, though, but Harriet Walter, between her and Ian Glenn and Geraldine James, I believe it is, what's going on with the accents?
Yeah, I had that note as well.
It's like Rebecca Ferguson is Swedish, and she's kind of doing a hybrid of that British and American.
Uh-huh.
Everyone else is kind of doing American. And it's like, is this like a... The Expanse, you know, that show where they do, the people who live in the moon colony or whatever do have weird accents because they've been separated from Earth for so long.
Yeah.
Like, it just, that threw me. It's a minor nit to pick, but like, it just kind of made me laugh throughout the show.
Yeah, not that minor, because Harriet Walter seems like she's doing some kind of like prospector voice. Like, I know that sort of goes with her character.
Yeah, but like in South Africa, I just could not figure out, like, are we supposed to not care? It just reminded me of like that show Fortitude, where they're like, everybody has the accents they have because this is like international.
Mm-hmm.
This is an international town.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, should we touch on this link that we've been alluding to we wrap it up?
So
I guess
I will try to explain this in non-spoilery terms so you don't have to fast forward. I was invested to see the season through. I was entertained. I was intrigued. I was enjoying the ride. But at the end of the season, there's a reveal that's sort of analogous to when, like in a different type of show, they kill the big bad and introduce the big bad's boss for the next season.
Right. Yes.
That sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, man, lost flashbacks, you know, stuff like that. It was all coming to me. I'm like, I enjoyed it, But boy, I've been burned before by this type of escalation of events.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll just check up on what the source material has to say about where the story is going. I'll be spoiler, but, you know, here we go. So I looked it up, and I don't really feel the need to go into season two. I don't think necessarily it's going to be like this terrible mess, but just where the story goes, there is a lot of science magic explaining away of things.
Yeah.
Midichlorians.
Yeah, basically. Midichlorians. And are you getting the good midichlorians or are you getting the bad midichlorians?
Yeah.
Are you getting enough midichlorians in your diet?
Yeah.
Feels like what a lot of writing out of situations happen for the story beyond season one. I think season one's solid.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if what I saw on the last few frames of season one is the end of the story in my headcanon, I am fine with it. The rest of the story sounds pretty silly to me.
Yeah. Richard, it sounds like you said you read ahead as well.
I did. Can I?
You can spoil if you want. Just
yeah, you can.
Just
go ahead.
Just let me play this first for the people.
Spoilers ahoy.
All right.
Oh, that was Harriet Walter.
There was.
I did like, because, you know, somewhere maybe mid-season, you're like, okay, it's actually good out there. This is all just sort of like some cult that, you know, is keeping people oppressed.
Yeah, that's what I assumed from the beginning.
Yeah. And I did like that they challenged that by saying, oh, no, it is poison outside. Like, everything is horrible and destroyed. But there are just more silos.
Mm-hmm.
And in reading more about where the books go, that started to sound kind of exhausting, where it's like, are we going into another gray-green world? Like, just with different characters? Or...
Yeah.
How different are these silos going to be? And I guess that could potentially be interesting.
Silo 4, party silo!
I was just going to say, like, it's the Jimmy Buffett silo!
Wait, unless there's a gay silo. Okay, then I'm invested. If that's what season two is about, that's just fine.
Yep.
But I think that I tend... Like, you know, I'm someone who watches Yellow Jackets and wants it to be supernatural. Like, I kind of want a bigger thing.
Yeah.
Than just this kind of practical, like, no, they're just not the only people underground.
Right.
And I just don't know how to make that compelling in future seasons.
Mm-hmm. We'll see or we won't, I guess. Depends on how many people watch this one or how desperate Apple is.
All right, it's time to go around the dial talking about what we've been watching on TV lately. First up, Tara.
Hello. The Other Two is back. For those of you who don't follow us on Instagram, every Friday on our Instagram story, I pose a question asking what people are going to be watching over the weekend. Last Friday, overwhelmingly, the majority of our followers said season three of The Other Two. I concur. I don't need to remind you what the show's about since Esther just presented a canon on it a couple of weeks ago. Season two ends right on the precipice of the initial COVID lockdown. Season three picks up a few years after that. Night Nurse, the movie that Carrie's whole notoriety had gotten uncanceled in Esther's canon episode, is coming out after what we're told is the most COVID delays of any movie ever. The pandemic also made Lance revise his priorities and give up fashion design to become a nurse. This is very annoying to Brooke, who feels insecure about the frivolous parts of her job as a manager. One of her clients is doing very well, however, because after acknowledging Pat's extreme burnout from hosting her talk show, her team has launched a signature lifestyle TV network for her instead. So now she is unbelievably rich, but also only has to work for 5 minutes a month and is so famous she can't live a normal life. Chase is still famous also, although his second album flopped because it came out on January 6, 2021. So there's a lot of repositioning him because he turns 18 in the premiere as well. This is one of the funniest and fastest shows on TV right now. Progressing the characters upward in their careers has given the writers new fodder to satirize the industry with. I don't want to spoil anything more than I already have, but the sheer volume of jokes you will see in the fifth episode, which is called Carrie and Brooke Go to an AIDS Play, is staggering and includes a devastating emotional scene as well that completely lands. Lance remains the norm of the show's satire. He is still one of TV's very sweetest idiots. Lance forever. I love Lance. It's such a great show. Everyone who didn't already say on Instagram they were watching it should plan to do so now. And Richard, you reviewed it, which we will link to the show notes. Did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think it's great. I think the first couple episodes of this season I found a little wobbly because I think I was just trying to get back into the... I forgot how absurdist it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it kind of turns that dial up in this season, which I ultimately came to like. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you highlighted a devastating emotional scene. I think Drew Tarver, Lainey York, and Molly Shannon, all three of them in the season, get these big moments that are sort of more dramatic, and I think they're all really well played.
Yep.
Brandon Scott James from Ghosts has been really bumped up into like a regular actor in the season, and he's great. I love that it's gay depictions. I think it's very true to life, but also heightened in silly ways that are fun. And yeah, I think it's the funniest show on TV. I think it's the rare comedy on TV these days that is actually trying to be a comedy.
Yeah, I agree. And shout out to Curtis, the Brandon Scott Jones character, throwing an Australian Survivor viewing party, because that will be relevant later in this very podcast episode. So for plugs, I will link to Richard's review, as I mentioned. And I also wrote a pre-finale essay about the Conners and how we hear a lot about sad sitcoms these days, and it is the saddest, and no one talks about that, and it is a real bummer. So you can read that if you want to be depressed about what's going on with the Conners these days, because nothing good is the short version.
Hooray! Richard, what do you have for us?
In my never-ending journey through the world of reality TV, have recently decided that Alex Guarnaschelli, I believe is how you say her last name, Guarnaschelli, of the Food Network, is my favorite celebrity. She has two shows that are currently running, one called Chow House, C-I-A-O House. It's a cooking competition in Italy, where she is one of the two main judges. And then she has a competition show styled like Beat Bobby Flay, but a lot more likable because it's not Bobby Flay, called Alex vs. America, where three expert chefs in things as general as pork and then more specific like soul food compete against Alex in two rounds to see if she can win or if they can beat her and win a little bit of money. She's so compelling. She's very real. She's funny. She's self-deprecating and self-effacing in a way that doesn't feel put on or obnoxious. I really genuinely think that she is who we're seeing on TV, at least to, you know, enough of a degree that it's believable. And I just find her very entertaining. Her food looks great. She's not fussy. And she does not have that Bobby Flay arrogant, let me kind of put these random yokels in their place attitude. She's very encouraging of her competitors, which I enjoy. So both of those shows, Chow House, where she's not cooking, she's just judging. She's a tough critic. And I think that is exactly what these shows need, especially outside of the realm of Top Chef. Because on Food Network, they can be too nice, I think.
Love it. And what do you have to plug?
How about this? I'm doing a podcast about Succession, which is about to end, still watching, where it's me and my coworker, Chris Murphy. We go episode to episode. The episodes air, we drop them on Sunday nights after the Succession episodes aired on the East Coast. So we're almost done with that. And then I think after that, we might be doing something in the Sex and the City realm. Hint, hint. So, yeah.
Oh, still my watching. God. I'm excited.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Secrets of the dead. Here's one secret. They're not dead. Just kidding. They are. This is a PBS program. So this is the nonfiction equivalent of a cozy mystery when it chooses to take on true crime. And if you have a PBS passport login and need some educational telly to fall asleep to, I recommend Secrets of the Dead, starting with the most recent one that I screened, the Caravaggio heist. Said heist took place in 1984. Two dudes headquartered in a shoe factory on Malta, obviously, yoinked Caravaggio's St. Jerome writing from a church. After a couple of years of trying to move it in the black market without success, they contacted the art historian Friar at the church's associated priory with a very drama queen-y cassette to see if the church/government wanted to buy the painting back. And then the ransom negotiation began. Secrets of the Dead isn't a terribly well-made show, and the reenactments are remarkably budge, even for the true crime genre, but A, it's PBS, so you forgive them to an extent, and B, in this episode, Father Marius Zarafa, the friar I mentioned earlier, is in the reenactments as himself, which is particularly adorable since he was in his 90s when this episode was filmed.
Wow.
And he is pottering around in his hiked up, shapeless old man khakis and a pair of mandals, rolling his eyes into an old style European phone handset and obviously having the time of his damn life. He earned it. Father Zarafa passed away in October of last year, and I am so glad for him that he got to do this before he got called home to the great art museum in the sky. With that said, this is an informative episode, but it sent me down an unanswered questions rabbit hole. This is not the only stolen Caravaggio. What did happen to that other one that got stolen in 1969? Nothing nice. Probably.
Yeah.
The two guys who got arrested for this theft had both died by the time the trial even ended. What is up with that? Is it the mafia? I can't even tell based on proper nounless allegations made in talking head interviews. And then there's Caravaggio himself, who had what we would probably call an impulse control problem, repeated law enforcement contact. Was he mentally ill or literally not responsible because of the lead paint poisoning? Experts are pretty sure killed him in his 30s. So at the end of the episode, I had like 18 Chrome tabs open. But if you're just listening to the thing on your iPod at bedtime, you're probably fine. I will have more on Secrets of the Dead at my newsletter, Best Evidence. It is a true crime review newsletter. Eve Beatty and I, every weekday, try to find the true crime that's worth your time. And I'm going to be making a list of all the Secrets of the Dead episodes that are crimey. Check that out, plus 4 years of our archives at bestevidence.fyi.
Just quickly, I just want to say, if you haven't watched Star Wars Visions Season 2, which is their collection of short animated stories, there is one that is actually genuinely worth your time, even if you're not like a super fan, and that's called Screecher's Reach. It is genuinely fucking creepy. I was actually very impressed they actually told that story and put it on Disney Plus. If you have young kids, don't let them watch that one. It's actually kind of scary. So Screecher's Reach, PG-13 material, definitely worth your time. Coming up right here on EHG this Friday, we're going to have for you, buckle in, we've got Muppets Mayhem, the new Dr. Teeth and Electric Mayhem series from Disney Plus. And because we're talking Muppets, we're going to bring in Adam Grossworth for this episode. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to do Ask EHG, answer some of your questions. And then they debut, as we said up top, of not quite winners and losers of the week. And then our extra credit topic is, and the pilot goes to, Tara, quickly.
You have to take one acting winner from this year's Oscars and one acting winner from last year's Oscars and come up with a pilot for them to do together.
You can get that whole episode if you sign up for our club. You can do so at extrahotgreat.com/club to get your hands on that extra, extra hot great episode. And they're right here on EHG Prime next week. It is the summer TV preview with new guest Philip Maciak. Don't miss it.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Now, before we hand it off to Rich to talk about the episode this week, I want to say, if you haven't watched this episode, this is Australian Survivor, Season 10, Episode 7. You might want to go watch it before the presentation and then come back to it.
Yes.
That's all I'll say. You might be sad if you haven't watched the episode first. Because we're going to spoil some things for you. And once you hear them, you can't unhear them.
Good
Richard,
man.
Take it away.
Yeah. So I mentioned, you know, my journeys through reality TV. I, after many years away, recently got back into Survivor thanks to my favorite streaming service, Paramount Plus. I'm not saying that ironically. It has Challenge. It has Survivor. It has other things. I'm into it. And so I went through probably 15 so seasons, 16 seasons in a really horrifyingly short amount of time and said, okay, what now? And a good friend of mine who's a Survivor diehard has auditioned for the show. He recommended Australian Survivor, but it was daunting because the seasons are really long. They're there for 46 days. There are, at the beginning of the seasons, I think 3 episodes a week.
Whoa.
You know, they're 90 minutes each, really. I mean, sometimes without commercials, like they're very long. It's a long, you know, it's a daunting prospect to start a Australian Survivor season. But I did. Heroes versus villains. So it's some returning people and some new faces. They were all new to me. But you do sorely, before this episode, before episode 7, you kind of are able to get the lay of the land in terms of two of the major players. The most major being King George, as he calls himself, who had been to final tribal in his season of the show, and then lost at the jury vote because he was too scheming, too unlikable, and so someone more likable got the win. So he comes back with a vengeance, as does a player called Simon, who is, like many of the men on Australian Survivor, which I'm not saying is not a reason to watch it, is, you know, young, buff, young, dumb, full of insert, whatever, and really is one of those guys who fans of American Survivor will recognize just as easily, who just really thinks that he's like the total package. He's got the physical game, he's got the mental game, he's going to do it. He's very cocky, very arrogant, which, of course, bothers George, King George, to no end, because this is supposed to be his winning season. So episode 7 is where the tensions between George and Simon, who were both on the villains tribe together, really come to a head, which is, we'll have Jordy, the hottest boy that's ever been on Survivor ever, I think. We'll have him explain some of that situation in the first clip.
Jordy. George just goes, "Are you going for a swim, mate?" And Simon goes, "What does it look like?"
Oh, God.
And I'm like, whoa. What about just saying, yeah, I am?
Simon is my best mate in here. However, it's been awful the last few days. I'm seeing cracks emerge. People are frustrated with Simon. Sean, Liz and George, they're all fed up with him. It's come down to a really tricky situation.
So what you don't hear in that clip is that Jordy, who is one of the jocks of the season, he figures out that when the villains merge with the heroes have been winning, you know, immunity challenge after immunity challenge. They are, the villains are getting winnowed down to nothing. But when the merge happens, Simon, the jock, will want to go with the hero jocks. And Jordy, in theory, because he's one of them too, would want to do that as well. But they wouldn't have the numbers then. So this is where Jordy, who has kind of been a peripheral player, starts to kind of teeter on his jock alliance, essentially. Later in the episode, the villains yet again lose the immunity challenge and have to go to tribal. There is another guy named Jerry who got sent to the villains briefly from the heroes tribe to kind of get intel. That becomes very relevant later in the season, but it's not that germane to this episode. You will hear his name mentioned in the next clip. But anyway, the point is they go to tribal with Jordy kind of not sure which way to go. George wants Simon out. Simon wants George out. And things between them come to pretty very quickly in this long tribal council. I believe in the episode on YouTube, the tribal council is like 40 minutes long. Simon and George just start sniping at each other, which is the next clip.
Who knows what Jerry's plan was, but I know what the plan is tonight. And the plan is to strengthen this tribe by chopping off the weak. And that's what I'll be doing at the voting booth tonight.
You can't vote for yourself, mate.
What do you mean by that, Simon?
You're not our strongest horse in the stable.
And another beautiful example of Simon's way with words. He's just, you know, he's just so eloquent.
The best, though, in the clip is, and you can kind of hear it, is they cut to Jordy as he goes,
yeah. Oh, Jordy is just like, no, don't say that. Don't say that. Don't get George riled up. Like,
yeah.
Jordy at this point, I think, has pretty much made up his mind that Simon is a liability. And even though George is very threatening as a player, what you can't obviously see in audio clips is that George has these crazy bug eyes.
Yeah.
That are like glistening with like menace and calculation. And he's just a fascinating character who, episode by episode, you love him, you hate him. And I think that's the best kind of Survivor character.
Yep.
As the tribal goes on, things get more and more tense. Let's go to the next clip and then I can maybe explain what's happening in that clip.
George, the fact that you put yourself on a pedestal, you call yourself a king, that's what grinds my gears, George.
It's just jealousy, Simon. That's what grinds your gears.
Let me finish.
No, you cut me off before. I have not done anything to you in this game. I've been civil to you. You've literally yelled at me. And then you are so passive-aggressive, you feel the need to speak over me. Never make this game personal, Simon. Never.
Thank you, George, for that.
Don't make the same mistakes you made in the Outback.
I'm not going to.
So what that clip, I think that really zeroes in on what I find so canon-worthy of this Survivor episode is that people who've watched any version of Survivor know that one of the core foundational sort of dynamics, and it's one of the most frustrating ones, is the chauvinist male sort of dominance of seasons. They're favored by juries. They talk a big game. They corral people because, you know, there was one women's alliance like 15 seasons ago. Now all the men are perpetually terrified of that. And so they vote women off as fast as they can. And George, you know, is a man too, but he's gay. And so he's aligned mostly with women. Here is George just trying to explain to Simon that, like, you are not as good at this as you think you are. I am better at this. And it's totally foundationally threatening to Simon's whole worldview and view of himself. And it's just fascinating to watch that get more and more pumped up as this tribal goes on. There is then a surprise, as there often is in Australian Survivor, which is there is an immunity challenge within tribal council. They have to build a long stick, get a key, and then make a fire. And who wins? Simon, who was supposed to go home that night, even though he has what he thinks is an immunity idol. Turns out it's fake, but he doesn't know that, and no one at Tribal knows that. So Simon cannot go home, and now it's a question of who will go home. George, there's a lot of scrambling with his allies and Simon's imagined allies, and let's go to the next clip, and then I can explain what's happening. I think it's easier that way.
Well, are you going to save Steve with your idol, Simon? Pressure's on. Yeah. Are you a hero or a villain?
So what George has done with using tricksy voting is make it so that Simon will have to give up his idol for Stevie, who is another guy on the tribe who is not maybe ideologically aligned with Simon, but at least at this point strategically aligned with him. And so George is forcing Simon to prove whether or not he's a noble player in the way he likes to talk about, or if he's just kind of down in the muck with everyone else. It's a little cruel. He's embarrassing Simon, but like after episodes of Simon kind of swaggering around, it feels pretty welcome, I have to say. And also just in the grander scope of Survivor as a whole, we do not get moments like this very often. And so it's very satisfying. And it keeps being satisfying. Let's listen to the next clip.
Simon, we are one third through the game. You've made a lot of mistakes. You've treated me as your enemy when I'm not. Better the enemy battering down at your front door of the fort than the traitor within. Geordie was going to do something to you much, much worse than what Danny did to you in the Outback, because Danny didn't pretend to be your best mate like Geordie does. Geordie's told every single person here about your rival.
So George is doing all this as if he's written this beforehand. Like he's just monologuing and just delivering blow after blow as Simon sits there, totally shocked. And I think it's interesting that George also kind of throws Geordi under the bus. Geordi had gone up to him and said, I think I don't want to vote with Simon anymore. And you could say that Geordi was collateral damage, but I think Geordi also does in some way represent this toxic straight male dominance that has so infected Survivor over the years. And so, unfortunately, he has to kind of go out with the bathwater, you know. And George is really now making his grand point and reveling in it, which is the next clip.
This is good for one tribal council. And if you don't save Steve tonight, talking about loyalty, you will literally stand for nothing. I'll make you a deal because this is what I do, Simon. We are both waking up on Villains Beach tomorrow, but you know who your enemy is, who you can deal with, and you know who the traitor from within is. I'm begging you, please save Steve. Please start this new third of the game as a hero, not as a villain. Because all of these people have voted for Steve. And that's my pitch to you, publicly. I'm playing this for me, Jonathan.
That's George playing his very much real idol. The strategy here is kind of astounding. Like, to have thought this through at tribal council, scrambling with people to get the votes to go exactly the way that George wanted them to go, or at least how he wants Simon to think they went. There's another trick up George's sleeve that makes this tribal, I think, really pushes it over the top of exciting. I should mention, sitting there, this entire 40-minute tribal council is a guy named Fraser, who has not spoken once, does not speak once, at least in the edited version of the tribal council. He's kind of just like around, you know, he's kind of dead weight that people are carrying around because I could probably beat him in the final, whatever. He's just sort of a non-entity. And so while George makes Simon think that it's, you know, either I give up my idol or Stevie goes home, and Simon eventually says, sorry, Stevie, his closest ally, I can't use my idol on you. I need it later. And so what happens is, well, the next clip.
Sixth person voted out of heroes versus villains. Fraser.
Checkmate. Now you know who you can trust tomorrow, Steve. This was a test. Thank you for the conversation at camp. It really meant a lot to me, and that's why I saved you. Okay, now you know.
Now you know. So George had no intention of sending Stevie home. He just wanted to make a fool of Simon to out him as a scrambly player. Look, everyone on Survivor is a scrambly player. I mean, some people are loyal, I think, to a fault. But I think it was necessary for George's sense of not just victory in this episode or potential victory this season, but a broader Survivor victory to be this kind of cartoonish, silly gay guy who actually, it turns out, outsmarted Simon by, many orders of magnitude. It's unfortunate that poor Fraser, who seemed fine, had to get eliminated to prove that point. But it really puts Simon in a rough spot in the game and maybe in life, which is the last clip. It's a short one.
Enjoy being in a minority, Simon.
Yeah. And I think that's, I don't think he's just talking about Survivor. I think George is looking at this strapping young straight man who probably gets a lot of things coming to him in life just by dint of who he is. And at least in this one moment, George, King George, can wield his specific power against someone like that, against the whole system in that way. Maybe I'm being grandiose about it, but like what I love about Australian Survivor is they lean into that grandiosity. The music is much more dramatic and swelling and crashing and booming than is on the American version. You really feel this. I mean, watching this, I went from edge of my seat to standing about 1 foot away from the TV, jumping up and down, saying, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, while I was supposed to be doing work in the middle of a Tuesday. It's just an absolute joy of an episode. Yes, and most of that joy is not from the challenges that preceded it. It's really just this tribal. But I can't think of a tribal on any iteration of Survivor I've ever watched that matches this. And so if you have to have an episode of Survivor in here, I'm sure you have others, but like in the canon, this would be absolutely, I think, one for the books because it instantly became, I think, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, Survivor moment among the, you know, Survivor community. So that's my submission.
Oh my God. Thank you so much. Okay, Sarah, why don't you start?
This was fascinating to watch just from a like comps standpoint. Like this guy, like the Australian Probst is so Probsty, but also obviously so Australian. But like the little differences, like it's not huge differences, but like there's a not raggediness, but it's less produced seeming, so the conflict and the scrambling feels tenser and more suspenseful. Like I don't think the US version, and I have seen maybe half of the 148 seasons of American Survivor, I don't think they've ever had another immunity challenge in the middle of voting at tribal. I don't think Ace challenge monster, so to say, like Simon has ever started weeping because he won that thing and then been called on it. It's like, are you crying, bro? I was like, seriously, are you? And he's just like, it really meant a lot to me to make a fire, which is like the most basic thing they tell you to learn before you go on a season of Survivor.
I made a pot of rice.
And then the Aussie Probst is like just sitting there, like leaning on his elbow jauntily on the votes, mm-hmm. waiting for them to stop fighting, mm-hmm. which if we saw it going on for whatever 39 minutes,
yeah,
it was probably like 4 hours. They had to take a bunch of pee breaks. Yeah. He's like texting people. He's fighting off a snake. I would love to see just footage of like what he was up to. He's like filing his nails. So that was really fun. And then as always happens in Survivor, and I think this is a spatial relations thing, like I eventually lose track of who might be able to do what, and it's just like, all right, I'll just figure it out retroactively when they count the votes because I don't know what's happening. So I'm easy to get that reaction from, but this still was like, whoa. And the fact that it's not as produced means that the tension was greater, and then the sort of release of that tension was greater. And seeing a guy literally and figuratively in his backwards baseball cap just get like punched in the tits by a gamer, and then he has to go back to camp with them, it is really satisfying. And yeah, this is a long episode. Maybe the seasons are long, but like, because I wasn't all that familiar with it, and because it feels so much less built and so much less like purposefully and cynically manipulative, I really enjoyed it and thought it was like very satisfying and earned this outcome. But also, you know, poor Fraser, who was like, oh, I was a red shirt. Wow. Then he can't even leave. Like, they're still fighting. Aussie Probst has to be like, can we just douse his flame and then you can go back to sniping each other? Great. Mm-hmm. The tribe has spoken. Okay, carry on. Like
Stevie says, he's having his goodbye moment. Give him that goodbye moment.
I know. Yeah. I know. Let him have that. It really was fascinating. And I think that this production team definitely understands like what they should keep about the original and what they should sort of leave out, and that they let George continue his reign of being this, like, my notes say, a not unpleasing cross between Richard Hatch and Drew Valentine from Dawson's Creek.
Don't yeah.
know how I pulled that guy. He was cute. Maybe that's it, but definitely the like Manson lamps happening. Mm-hmm. This was like just so much fun to compare and contrast, but also because it makes you pull apart sort of both versions and see like, well, why does this, what about this formula works, and what about adapting it can also work even better. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this was really something, and it was processy as hell for Survivor. So that's, you know, that's bunt nip, as you may or may not know, but like the man said, now you know.
I'll go next. I want to back up to the immunity challenge that the villains lose, because that's also part of George's strategy, which is, you know, if they win, it's great. But if they don't, they're going to set it up. So it's like, tell Simon he only, it's like a rolling a ball in water thing. It doesn't matter. But he tells Simon his job is to defend the ball, because he's not going to be able to, he's going to want to go over and like push the ball instead. Like basically, if we win, great. If we don't, it'll be on Simon, because he didn't, his ego is going to get in the way. He's so like this that he won't be able to just defend, and you know, so that part works. And then we have like the scrambling before tribal, where Simon he talks to Stevie. He names their strategy Operation Anaconda. Why not? He's going to go mole with George's alliance, and they rehearse reasons that he's going to say Simon has to go, including Simon's like, well, you know, you could just say like me telling you what to do all the time, like completely oblivious to fact that that's exactly what he's doing in that moment. Mm-hmm. And like Stevie's like, all right, like he doesn't really seem that passionately, you know, connected to Simon, as Richard said, but like he goes and has this conversation with George, and George is like, interesting. And then the tribal, it's like to say that it's cruel to Simon what he's doing, but it's satisfying. It's like, yes and no. Even at not having seen the rest of the season, you can tell what a fucking asshole Simon is. Like, he's so arrogant. Even if this is all you've seen, and it was to this point all I had seen of the season, it's like, this is a guy who needs his comeuppance real bad. And like, he clearly just has no concept of how any of this works. And George, you can hear it in the clips. He is so calm. Like, nothing about this rattles him. He has thought this through 17 moves in the future. And, like, even if what ended up happening was what seems like it's going to happen, which is, you know, trying to flesh out Simon's hidden immunity idol, if that works, okay, fine. At least he won't have it for the next time. Or Stevie getting voted out, if that had happened, and be like, okay, he's already made Simon completely turn on his own self-narrative of, I'm a good guy. I'm not like George, this little scheming bitch. I'm like a decent, I'm a hero. And so for George to like use that against him is also very part of what makes it so satisfying, because it's clear Simon is completely full of shit. As Richard said, everyone in the game is a schemer. That's the point. And so for the people who are in it, who are like, no, I'm going to play it a different way, it's like, well, goodbye. Like, it's not going to work. Never does. Like the other, and then for it to pay off where it's like the complete switcheroo with Fraser, and you realize retroactively George had to count on his alliance, his main alliance partners, Liz and Shawnee. Is that her name? Shawnee?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had to count on them being able to keep their shit together while George is like, all these people have voted for Stevie and not give anything away. And like partly, you know, the editing might be part of it because we don't flash to their faces to be like, oh my God, like what they might have been. I don't know. But whatever it was, no one apparently saw. And then, you know, poor Fraser. Even Fraser's like, well, you got me, gals. Like, he's smiling as they're snuffing his thing because it's such a great move. Like, everyone there, including Jonathan, Australian Probst, knows that they are in history. They are making history in this moment. And you kind of just have to be like, well, that's how it goes.
He knew he was a footnote now, and he might as well just play the role, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I was screaming too. Like, I was dying by the time we got to the end. And, you know, this is not a franchise that I have kept up with. Honestly, people bringing us episodes that are super bangers is a great way to experience the franchise. Mm-hmm. But having said that, at the end of this episode, I did keep watching. Like, I didn't just want to, I actually did. And I will finish this season because holy shit, what a tour de force. Dave.
Yeah. The Buncey Axis. Nice.
So we were watching Taskmaster Australia, the first season, a few months ago, and their promotional bug on the page was Survivor, the craziest fucking goddamn tribal council ever in the history of the universe. We're like, all right, give it a break. Settle down, guys. Fast forward a couple months to this thing. Like, all right, that was earned.
Yep.
That was the best episode of Survivor I've ever seen. Prior to this, I would have said my favorite episode, and I fell off Survivor literally decades ago. My favorite episode prior to this was the season 2 episode where they blindside Mitchell on the way to Tribal Council. Mm-hmm. And that was just simple grapevine discussion in the jungle on the way to camp, or on the way to council, rather. This one is like 100 times more satisfying as that one is. It is so Machiavellian. And there was a point in the episode where they first started making tribal council movements, like, all right, I guess it's time for tribal council, and I paused it. It was like 40 minutes in, and 40 minutes to go, I'm like, what the fuck is this show doing? 40-minute tribal council? And then the end of it, I was like, oh, boy, I could have done another hour of that. That was delicious.
Yeah.
Like, George's tribal council delivery, it is like, if Survivor needed a Bond villain, that guy was, that was his audition.
Yeah.
Like, just the way he spun everything. And the fact that, like, that plan had to change a couple times during the day because of this and that.
Yeah.
And it still all just sort of worked out like he didn't blink. Always going to be. It was just fate. You know, we were just along for the ride. Was extremely satisfying. Mm-hmm. More so because Simon is, like, a true turd of a person by what you see in this episode.
Yeah.
The first taste of that you get is like before Tribal Council proper, where they're first sort of coming up with a plan before it gets a couple of monkey wrenches thrown into it, where George is saying to his to the two girls that are part of his alliance that he thinks Simon could get blindsided. And one of them just like covers their mouth and says, "Oh, he's gonna cry."
Yes.
And it was just like, oh, okay. This is like some real high spite level stuff going on here. Mm-hmm. And that is what makes memorable Survivor TV for me.
Yep.
So I was very much into it. I don't remember anything from before the Tribal Council. There was some old dude that was switching sides. There was a ball game. Mm-hmm. But really the only thing I have to say about the stuff before it is, wouldn't a good strategy during the ball game would be to pull people's pants down? You think that's a rule? No pantsing?
I said they're Australian. They've all seen each other's junk all the time.
Oh, they're naked. They're naked a lot.
Oh, are they?
And also people. There have been people who finish challenges topless, like women, and like that doesn't matter.
Okay, all right. Well,
maybe they could reset.
Fine.
Can I offer just like a tease about, you know, just like if people are curious, like.
Well, Richard, I'm not fart-arsing around, so go ahead.
I think this episode is really fun. It's significant in a way, but the real fun of the rest of the season is figuring out not necessarily what George's enemies have to do with him, but what his allies do. Like, George, I think shortly after this, I started rooting against George because that's how dynamic this season is.
Wow.
So if you're interested, it stays interesting. I'll just say that.
And it's on YouTube. We should say.
Yes, it was originally this wonderful person, Macy76. We don't know who she is. She's gay Twitter famous at this point because she was just posting all the Australian survivors. She's gone away, but someone else has replaced her. And so, yes, I believe all the episodes of this season are on YouTube at the moment.
Yeah.
I'll leave you a final thought why I thought this was such a great episode. There is a moment in Richard explained it in the Tribal Council where there's a challenge in the middle of Tribal Council. And in the moment, I was like, oh, come on. This is such, you know, putting the thumb on the scales of everything from the producers. But I can't argue with the results. So, nope. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to give them a pass here where I would get extremely angry and just say, fuck you, Amazing Race, when they did it with Rob in the airport and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm done with this show. But here, like, the results, the ROI to me, large.
Yes. If we found out retroactively that, like, Simon's sticks were like stiffer and longer than everyone else's, I would still be like, fine. Like, it got us where we needed to go. Yeah, exactly.
We are running along. So let's just put this to the official vote. I think I know how it's going to go. But Sarah D. Bunting, canon worthy, yay or nay?
We're here to have fun, not be arseholes to this episode. So it's a yay for me.
Tara?
Glory or death? Yes. Yay, absolutely.
Yeah, me too. All right, so that means Australian Survivor Season 10, Episode 7, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, it's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It's people choosing to vote Union Yes with their feet. Drew Barrymore stepped down as the host of the MTV Movie and TV Awards in solidarity with the WGA. Lala Kent of Vanderpump Rules, whatever, but at least she did the right thing, also sitting out the show in solidarity. And by Friday, producers of said show had announced that it would be pre-taped and just a clip show, kind of, which is kind of what everyone wants anyway, I suspect. Mm. And finally, David Simon, who was picketing HBO at the moment they suspended his deal with the network after a quarter of a century. Great job, everybody.
We should clarify for anyone who does not keep up with entertainment news, the reason that everyone's in solidarity with the WGA is because they are currently striking, and we support them and we support workers. And here's who we don't support. The losers, Scab Productions, that were shut down by WGA picketers. Severance, Billions, Evil. That one, they caused the season to wrap early, and all it took were four picketers on the scene, one of whom was Starley Kine, who people know from Mystery Show? Is Mystery that what your podcast? Mystery Show, and before that, This American Life. Over in L.A., Loot got shut down. Daredevil Born Again got shut down. The entertainment industry, also losers of the week. They lost $10 billion of value on the first day of the WGA strike and got called out at the White House by President Joe Biden, saying he thought the writers should get a fair deal. So if even he is saying it, shit must be bad.
Speaking about not getting a fair deal, do you know what time it is?
No. Gotta be game time.
All right, everybody, this is the first game time of a fresh new season. Today we are playing Test Pilot 2 Return Flight from Erica, who earns herself an extra credit topic of their choosing, and now officially announcing, and she gets a free shirt or giga from the Through Methods store. Hey, thanks to the Patreon campaign, there's a few more dollars in the coffers. We figured let's reinvest some of that into the content you provide. So if you give us something good and we use it, why not? Free shirt. Yum. Shirt. I will give you the title of the first episode of a TV series, and a correct answer at this point is worth 4 points. If you need a hint, you will hear the title of the last episode in the series, after which the answer is worth 3 points. If you still need a hint, I will give you the year the show began and the network. And after that, somebody from the cast that you might know. 1 point. So the more hints you ask for, the less points you get. You can guess at every level, but I am going to go lickety-split because that's a lot of clues potential. So, you know, if you're not with 5 seconds or so, I'm just going to give you that next clue. And you're just going to have to live with it. All final episode titles refer to the main first run of the show. So we're not talking about any reboots, revivals, that kind of stuff. There are a few little tweaks as we go along, but I'll explain them as we hit them. We're not going to do steel mails today because of the nature of the game. So let's just throw it to Pinky to see who is going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. That means Richard is in pole position. Oh,
no.
Then Sarah, then Tara. 27 questions. No equalizer challenge zones today. Are we ready to play Pilot Test 2 Return Flight?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Sure.
All right. Richard, this is round one. These are titles of the actual first episodes. Therefore, the episodes are not called simply pilot. They actually have real titles. So your first episode title is A Study in Pink. Can you name the show just off the first episode? If you absolutely don't know it, just ask for the next hint. We'll roll right into it.
Rise of the Pink Ladies.
The end title is The Final Problem.
I have no idea.
It debuted in 2010 on BBC.
2010 on BBC.
A Study in Pink, The Final Problem, 2010 BBC.
I genuinely...
Your last clue, here's an actor involved, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, Sherlock.
Sherlock got that point at the end. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
The first episode title is Everything is Fine.
Everything is Fine. I feel like I should know this, but I don't. Next hint, please.
The last episode is called Whenever You're Ready.
I don't think this is right, but Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
It debuted 2016 NBC.
This is Us?
One of the actors involved was William Jackson Harper.
Oh, right. Good Place.
Good Place, also good for
Good Place.
Tara.
Yes.
Your first episode is called Emissary.
Battlestar Galactica.
Last episode is What You Leave Behind.
Oh no, I should know it off that, and I don't. Six feet under.
It debuted 1993, and it was syndicated.
Is 93. Is this Deep Space Nine? Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
It is. Good for 2 points. Nicely done. Back to Richard. The first episode of this show is called Space Pilot 3000.
Futurama.
Futurama is our first 4-point get. Nicely done. Sarah.
Yeah.
The first episode is called Extreme Aggressor.
Law and Order SUV.
Your last episode, and here's one of the wrinkles. If your very last episode is simply called The End or a variation of, we're going to give you the penultimate and the last episode at the same time. So your last two episodes are Face Off and In the End. And In the End is the finale.
In the End. Oh, well, this is not right, but Angel?
This show debuted 2005 on CBS.
CBS?
Yes.
NCIS?
Paget Brewster is your actor.
Is it that shit with Red John? Why can't I think of the name? I don't know the answer.
Anybody else know it? No points. But
Criminal Minds.
Criminal Minds is the correct answer.
Oh.
Back to Tara.
Yes.
The Golden Parachute is the debut episode.
Next.
Habeas Corpse is the final.
Oh, cool. Golden Parachute. Next.
2002, CBS.
Is this CSI Miami?
Wow.
2 points. Back to Richard. Your first episode title is The Terrible Secret of Turtle Bay.
I don't know. Next.
The Saffrax
Protocol.
Protocol. Yes.
The Terrible Secret of Turtle Bay, The Saffrax Protocol. I am going to say, I don't know, Star Trek Voyager.
Show started 2003 on Cartoon Network.
Oh, Christ. Powerpuff Girls?
And finally, an actor who is a voice actor in this particular show, of course, Patrick Warburton.
The Tick.
Looking for the Venture Brothers here. Venture Brothers.
Oh, never even heard of it. I mean, I guess I have.
Sarah G. Bunting. First episode is called The Target.
The Target.
The Target.
Dexter.
The last episode is Dash 30 Dash.
Sports Night?
2002 HBO.
Oh, fuck. The Wire.
The Wire. 2 points. Here's our last question of round one for Tara.
Mm-hmm.
First episode is called The Mama Who Came to Dinner.
Is this Gilmore Girls?
Shit. Last episode is called Lost in Space Part 2.
Are you sure it's not Gilmore Girls? Lost in Space Part 2. Is this Star Trek Voyager? Shit.
1989 ABC.
Oh, no. I don't know. Next.
Joe Marie Payton is your actor.
Anything but love.
Anybody know it?
No.
That was Family Matters. Family Matters.
Oh.
All right. Let's get scores, please.
It's pretty close. Sarah has 3. I have 4. Richard has 5.
All right. Let's get right back into it. In our second round, all of these series that we're going to talk about actually began with a pilot episode called Pilot. So you're going to get the second episode of the series and the last episode of the series.
Gotcha.
So here we go. To Richard first. Second episode is called The Same Old Story.
Alaska Daily.
Last episode is called An Enemy of Fate.
Early edition.
This show debuted 2008 on Fox.
Grimm.
This show, one of the stars was the late Lance Reddick.
So, Fringe.
Fringe, yes, correct.
Nice.
For 1 point.
Is that really 2008?
God.
Sarah D. Bunting. The second episode of this series was called Summer Love.
Dawson's Creek.
The last episode is called Graduation.
sure it's not Dawson's Creek. Young Americans.
1989, NBC.
Saved by the Bell?
Saved by the Bell is correct. 2 points. Okay, Tara.
Yeah.
Your second episode is called Showmans.
Smash.
Your last episode is called Dreams Come True.
Is this American Dreams?
2009, Box.
Glee.
Correct. 4-2. Back to Richard. Your second episode is called Ah, But Underneath.
Lost.
Last episode, Finishing the Hat.
Mozart in the Jungle.
Love that guess.
2004, ABC.
Grey's Anatomy.
Marsha Cross is your actor.
Oh, Desperate Housewives.
Yes, good for one. Back to Sarah. Friends and Lovers is your second episode.
That's a billion shows.
Yeah, it seriously is. That and Changes. Brothers and Sisters.
Your last episode is Asses to Ashes. Asses to Ashes.
Asses to Ashes? Yep. Oh, God, what the fuck was the name of that show with the plastic surgeons and Ryan Murphy? I don't remember. Hint. Ooh.
1992, Fox.
Oh my God, I just got it.
The Prophet?
I don't know.
Your actor is Courtney Thorne Smith. Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, Jesus, really?
Hosted Melrose Again with this.
Place.
1 point for Melrose Place. In her defense, we have not yet got to the final.
We have
on
not.
That
Asses to Ashes.
Yep. Well, all right, Tara.
Yeah.
Your second episode. Your second episode is called Credit Where Credit's Due.
Okay, next.
The last episode is called The Bitch is Back.
Oh. Next.
2004, UPN.
Fuck. Is it Veronica Mars?
It is Veronica Mars.
It certainly is.
All right, everybody's last question is coming at you. So let's get a score update.
It's still really close. Sarah has 6. Richard has 7. I have 8.
All right, let's get right back into it. Richard, your last question. Second episode is called Thinergy. Thinergy.
Tuck.
The last episode is called Chicago Shoe Exchange. Which is a good hint.
Chicago PD.
This show debuted 1987 on Fox.
So, wait, I mean, isn't that Simpsons? No.
Your actor is Christina Applegate.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Yeah, Chicago was a good hint. Married with Children.
Married with Children, good for one final point. To Sarah D. Bunting, your second episode title of this show is called Trust Me.
L.A. Law.
Oh, what if it was?
The last episode is called And the Winner Is...
Push Nevada?
Wow.
1979 ABC.
Is this Benson?
It is, and that is good for 2 points. Nicely done. All right, last question of the game. It is for Tara.
Yes.
Windigo is your second episode. Windigo.
Next.
Last episode is called Carry On.
X-Files?
This show debuted 2005 on the WB.
Oh. Smallville?
Misha Collins is your actor.
Oh, Supernatural.
Supernatural is good for one. All right, that's regulation. Let's hear the final scores.
Richard and Sarah finished with 8 points each. I had 9.
Wow. Well done, everybody.
Good job, everyone.
Good job, everybody. All right, we're just going to play this tiebreaker quickly. I'm going to take a page out of Tara's book and make Tara sit out because she won. So this is between Sarah and Richard. First person to get the correct answer to shout it out whenever you think you know it will get a steel meal for future use. The debut episode of this show is called Wither Canada. The last episode of this show is called Party Political Broadcast.
SCTV?
This show debuted 1969 on BBC One.
Are you being served?
It starred Eric Idle.
Monty Python's Flying Circus.
I'm going to give that one to Richard. I heard him go on first. Monty Python's Flying Circus is the correct answer. Woo!
Tara.
Well done. Thank you, Erica, for that game. Sorry we had to cut some of the questions out. We are running long today. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We went deep down with the gritty outside Hall Pass show, Silo, before going around the dial with stops at the other two, Alex G's, see, I just truncate it, and problem solved, Food Network shows, and Secrets of the Dead. No surprise votes for Richard's successful canon pitch of Australian Survivor's Hero and Villain's 7th episode. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Erica. Next up, The Muppets Mayhem with Adam Grossworth on this Friday's Extra Extra Hot Great. And next week, right here on EHG Prime, it's the Summer TV Preview. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano, Sarah D. Bunting.
Spoiler, I'm never going to be doing any cleaning.
And Mr. Richard Lawson.
Gnar.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Have you any last words?
Sorry for all the fuss.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.